Today is Monday, August 10th, and this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We take you behind the news and into local culture to help us better understand this beautiful and complex Central Coast that we all share. I'm Gabriela Fernandez. More than a decade after the Refugio oil spill, offshore oil production has resumed off the Gaviota Coast under Sable Offshore. The restart has sparked a growing legal and political battle over whose authority it is to regulate the project, and whether the company's claims about lowering costs and reducing imports are true. In today's episode, I spoke with UC Santa Barbara political science professor Pasha Madavi about his research on Sable Offshore's claims.
So they made this claim that increasing production from the Santa Ynez unit would displace the oil that's coming in from abroad. So what I found is that that's simply not true. And the reason for that is primarily economics.
Then we touch on how federal and state budget cuts are expected to reshape healthcare coverage for millions of Californians. In this week's episode, Cap Radio's Insight host Vicky Gonzalez speaks with CalMatters health reporter Kristen Wong about her new documentary exploring what's at stake for Medi-Cal patients, providers, and the future of the state's healthcare system.
The One Big Beautiful Bill Act cuts about $1 trillion from healthcare over the next decade nationally. And in California, when all of the rules and regulations are fully in effect, California expects to lose about $30 billion a year, which is 15% of the current Medi-Cal budget.
Then we'll wrap up the program with a taste of Central Coast wine. KCBX contributor Mira Honeycutt sits down with the owners of Epoch Estate Wines, where history, innovation, and sustainable farming come together in a Paso Robles vineyard.
When I came to Paso in 2010, I knew that I wanted to produce wines that were not manipulated too much, as least as we possibly could in the vineyard and then in the winery.
All this coming up next. Questions about energy, economics, and government authority are colliding on California's Central Coast. Ever since Sable Offshore restarted oil production off the Gaviota Coast, the project has become the focus of lawsuits, regulatory disputes, and an escalating clash between California and the federal government. I sat down with UC Santa Barbara professor Pasha Madavi to unpack Sable Offshore's oil production claims and how the federal government's involvement could reshape the balance of power in California. One of the biggest arguments is that restarting this production reduces America's dependence on foreign oil. Can you just explain to our listeners what you found in your research?
So Sable Offshore has claimed that if it were able to restart production from these platforms that are in the what's called Santa Ynez unit in federal waters and off the coast of Santa Barbara, Gaviota specifically, they've claimed that restarting oil production from there would effectively replace or displace oil that's being imported to California. And I'll pause and just say that, you know, one of the big reasons for making that claim is that California does import a lot of oil from outside of California. This state where I grew up, we've been producing oil and gas in California since the late 19th century. We are a very, very old oil producer, which means that our production has declined and pretty much been in decline since the early 80s was when it peaked. And that means that California, which also has a lot of refineries, that's who ultimately will take in crude oil. We can't use crude oil itself. We have to convert it to something. Have been sourcing their oil from outside of California, whether it's from Alaska or from abroad, because California is very limited in terms of its connections to the rest of the United States, both in terms of pipelines, there's almost none, and railroads. And so we do import a lot of oil from outside the United States. This is an interesting thing for some, but I'll come back to that because it's somewhat irrelevant given that the crude oil market is global and it doesn't actually matter where you get your oil from. So they made this claim that increasing production from the Santa Ynez unit would displace the oil that's coming in from abroad. So what I found is that that's simply not true. And the reason for that is primarily economics. It's just based on how much it costs per barrel to produce oil, and who that would displace in the given market. You know, refineries and storage facilities, they don't really care where that oil is necessarily coming from. They care about the price and their contracts. If you want to displace foreign oil, you're going to have to come in under their break-even price. And for Sable, and for the San Ynez unit, given that it requires a lot of energy to produce this oil, it's, you know, an older reservoir, so it takes more money to get that oil out of the ground, not to mention all the repairs and everything else that they have to counter, comes in below, pretty much all foreign sources are coming in below what the San Ynez unit would produce in terms of its operating cost. Then it's, just to put some numbers on it, it's roughly in the ballpark of $40 to $50 per barrel to produce the San Ynez oil. Now, you compare that to, you know, Middle East oil, and even in the context of this war, there's still Middle East oil hitting market, Saudi Arabian oil, for example. You know, Saudi Arabian oil, from an actual operating cost, is somewhere between $2 and $6 a barrel. You got to add in freight and everything else, but it's still really, really low. It's coming in to port here at, you know, no more than $10, $12 a barrel. And then you've got all the other producers that are sending oil to California, Brazil, Ecuador, now Colombia, a host of others. And still, the oil that Sable's producing is more expensive. So the only thing that it's beating out is Canadian oil that's actually sent to California via rail. So what's happening then? So Sable's bringing this oil online. It must surely be displacing something. The answer is it's likely displacing onshore California production. That's just slightly more expensive than what Sable is producing. So if anything, they're not actually displacing foreign oil at all. They're displacing domestic oil. Okay, that's the most likely outcome. Or you're not displacing anything and you're exporting your oil, which means that you've processed it, you've sold it to a distributor, and the distributor decides to sell it internationally. But what's definitely not happening here is any displacement of foreign oil based just on the numbers alone. And the numbers that I came up with are based on Sable's own investor presentations and documents. And interestingly enough, they were verified in a state Senate hearing by representatives of the industry when they were directly asked if this operating cost is roughly in that range, 40 to 50. And they concurred, yeah, it is roughly in that range per barrel. Based on your cost, and that's the stated cost on at least the legislative record, Sable's barrels are too expensive to displace foreign oil, and they're not decreasing our reliance on foreign supply to California.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. I'm speaking with UCSB professor Pasha Madavi about his research on Sable Offshore's oil production claims on the Gaviota Coast. So we've seen the Trump administration invoke the Defense Production Act, which essentially asserted federal jurisdiction over these pipelines. From your perspective, how important is this evidence when the federal government is making these kinds of claims?
This kind of law, the Defense Production Act, is meant to be used and invoked when there is emergency. And the Trump administration, interestingly enough, declared an energy emergency back in January 2025, well before these invasions of Venezuela and then Iran. There was no energy emergency then. And that's kind of what a lot of this is built on. There certainly is somewhat of an energy emergency now, although it's not quite the same as what people thought, given global storage capacity at the moment, which is why crude oil is roughly in the $85 per barrel range, which is why it's not $200 a barrel. We're not in emergency a moment. But then the other part of this, which doesn't make any sense, is oil has always been this global market. Producing something in one place doesn't really displace something in another place unless that oil isn't able to get to market. And there has been a reduction in the oil that's, you know, intended to hit the markets because of the invasion of Iran and the subsequent closure of the Strait of Hormuz. But by and large, storage still exists to offset some of that, thereby not necessitating kind of an emergency being declared. The other part of this as to why this is surprising in terms of an invocation of the Defense Production Act is what I just noted, which is, well, if Sable's oil isn't displacing oil that's coming in from abroad, and it's displacing oil that's likely just being produced in California or possibly in Alaska, how is that solving the emergency? And that becomes an interesting question around, you know, what this is intended to do. So it's hard to justify any way you look at it, the use of this law, given that there appears to be no emergency. Even after the war started, there's still oil that's flowing into markets. And so why use this particular rule to do so? The other piece of it, which is particularly troubling, is how the federal government is effectively overriding state and local jurisdictions. The Defense Production Act is meant to be invoked to try to push private industry to pressure them to produce goods that are needed by the country. Steel, right, is kind of the commonly thought of thing. And so it's usually done because there's not necessarily an initial economic reason for them to produce that much steel. And the federal government is saying, look, we need steel, produce steel. Here, what's happening is the market is already saying, well, you know, there is oil in storage, there's oil on the water. By and large, you're not seeing a market necessity for the invocation of the Defense Production Act. And so then you're saying, well, why else? And here you have the government saying, well, no, what we're trying to do is not solve a market problem. We're trying to solve a regulatory problem by invoking the Defense Production Act. And that's not what this is intended for. And here, what you have is the state of California saying, we need to do our proper review and oversight of this particular project. The pipeline runs through state park land, and the pipeline is going to affect state communities, so the community of Santa Barbara, and coastal communities up and down the Central Coast and all the way down to Los Angeles, for example. And the state and local governments are saying, this is our backyard, this is our jurisdiction to evaluate to see if this project meets the standards of state regulations. And the federal government is saying, no, we don't agree with that. We are going to invoke these kinds of rules to override your rules, the state of California, and your court cases, because these are ongoing instances of litigation in the case of Sable, and simply come in and just bulldoze state regulations. And I say that's troubling because, you know, we in political science and in the classroom, we teach governance and law and we teach American politics. And when we teach the founding of the United States, you, of course, spend a lot of time talking about federalism and the republic and the formation of states and state rights. In fact, there was an entire civil war ostensibly fought over state rights. The entire premise of this government, the United States, is that states do indeed have rights and do have the authority, especially over state lands, to govern those lands. You cannot come in and abuse the very notion of things like the Defense Production Act and eminent domain to override what a state and local authority intends to do. So that's incredibly troubling because of what it says for what is the United States and how states have any rights to govern what's happening within their borders.
I know you didn't write your report on, you know, state sovereignty and constitutional law, but as a political scientist, how do you think this is going to play out?
So I wrote my report before any federal intervention took place. So there was no sense that this would happen. You know, the report was written in February of 2025, and the first federal intervention occurred in December 2025 when the pipeline authority, PHMSA, kind of ruled that the pipeline was an interstate pipeline and therefore subject to federal jurisdiction. And then came the Defense Production Act, and then came eminent domain and this idea of a strategic petroleum reserve and so on and so forth, and lots of different federal interventions. So while my report didn't address that, I will say that this is a clear abuse of federal power. There's just no other word for it. It is trying to override state efforts to govern state lands in particular, never mind this kind of interface or overlap between state waters and federal waters. And so, and when I say that, there's this very unique component here that there's a roughly 3-mile section of the Santa Ynez pipeline system that goes through state waters, and a roughly 4-mile section of the pipeline system that traverses the Gaviota State Park. So these are state lands. The state of California should and does have jurisdiction over those lands. And for the federal government to say just a quick, no, you don't, is baffling. And so it's not clear, I can't comment on whether or not that logic is going to hold out in a court of law. But from everything that I understand about federalism and the effective contract between states and the federal government, this is none other than something that should be thrown out immediately as overreach by the federal government.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. I'm speaking with UCSB professor Pasha Madavi about his research on Sable Offshore's oil production claims on the Gaviota Coast.
Why do you think this fight matters so much to them, Sable and the federal government?
Well, there's two pieces to this. One is it's part of a broader agenda by the Trump administration to increase the production of fossil fuels, come hell or high water, and quite literally both of those, right? Both of those are consequences of climate change. The kind of drill, baby, drill agenda of this administration has been clear to everyone, again, effectively since day one. The executive order that Trump put out declaring an energy emergency in January of 2025 indicated as such. And so when viewed from that lens, this project fits the bill as one way that the federal government can override everything and increase oil and gas production, even when there are lots of, I mean, just the countless number of red flags in this particular case. But this applies elsewhere. This applies in Alaska. This applies in the Gulf of Mexico, off the coast of Florida. This applies to so many other places where the federal government is coming in and saying, nope, we're going to ramp up oil production, gas production, coal production, let's say, irrespective of what states, localities, or anyone else has to say about it, and even the federal government beforehand. So it is part of that particular approach that this administration has. And, you know, the administration has been effective in doing that, unfortunately. Just recently, the annual Statistical Review of Energy was published by the Energy Institute, which used to be published by BP. It's kind of a 75-year endeavor that has been providing data about energy issues, you know, globally on oil, gas, coal, and in fact, other energy sources, has noted that the United States, as a result of kind of the Trump administration's activities, has not only increased oil and gas production as it is intended, but when paired with everything else, has increased the emissions from greenhouse gases at a moment when everybody else is declining and when the United States itself had been declining. And so the administration has been successful in that agenda to ramp up fossil fuels, and we will pay the price when it comes to the impacts on the climate, not to mention the local environment. Now, the other reason is likely based on interactions that have been reported by the media between Sable Offshore and members of the U.S. government to try to prioritize this particular project. There are some cases actually ongoing regarding those interactions, so it's yet to be seen the implications of those, but it does suggest that there was some fast tracking of this particular project. And then I would say a third reason which comes to mind is that, you know, the administration is clearly targeting some states more than others. And there is a punitive element here that can't be ignored. The state of California has long bucked the trend of the Trump administration and, in fact, has led the way in the United States on decarbonization and ramping down emissions. And the administration doesn't like that and wants to single out a state that is going against its own agenda. That too is troubling. That's not how any democracy is supposed to be run. That's more the purview of autocracies and more the countries that I've studied throughout my career that punish those who don't go for the leader and support those that do. That's kind of a set of different things that seem to be at play here.
Have you heard any criticism of your analysis at all? And how do you answer to criticism?
I have definitely heard a lot of criticism of my analysis, mostly from people that are repeating oil industry talking points or those in the industry themselves. I've testified to, you know, the state assembly, the state senate on the basis of my analysis for broader conversations related to California's governance of offshore oil and pipelines, and just general questions around California's oil production. So I do hear a lot of criticism about it. And my response is, look, I'm just using data that's publicly out there and analyzing data, not only from the company itself, but from the state of California, from the feds themselves, the Energy Information Administration, and a bunch of agencies, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and so on and so forth. And to say, look, I'm just reporting what the data are saying. And you can certainly come up with different, you know, spin, but it's pretty hard to change the actual facts. But the other thing I'll say is that there's one point in particular that seems to be a talking point that comes up a lot, which is that, well, if only we increased production within California, that'll bring down gasoline prices. The California's government and laws are what are to blame for high gasoline prices. And make no mistake, gasoline prices are high in California. They're higher than the rest of the United States. But production of crude oil has nothing to do with it. It is a global crude oil market. Refineries get their oil from anywhere based on what the market is giving them. The cost is what matters. And transportation is a cost, but it's really a small one. So ramping up production just has nothing to do with these prices. And so we want to work to reduce prices of gasoline. But increasing production in California has nothing to do with that. And that's been a very hard talking point for some to accept because they think these two things are linked, but they're just not. That's not how the market works. It's not how the market has worked for a long time, given that we have, you know, competitive and free spot markets when it comes to securing crude oil.
If listeners could take one thing away from your research, what do you hope it is?
The one thing I would hope people can take away from the research I've done, not just here on Sable, but across energy issues related to the state of California and globally and nationally, is that the best way to reduce prices, if we are concerned about reducing prices for energy, is not through increasing oil and gas production, but rather through increasing electrification and advancing decarbonization. That ultimately, if we want cheaper prices, we need to move away from a non-renewable resource that's highly volatile and towards a system that is built on and predicated on clean energy that is effectively free. The sunshine and wind, and of course, the heat beneath our feet, things like geothermal. So that's the one thing I would hope people take away. If we want lower prices, we've got to switch to a different system. And lots of other places around the world are doing just that in the face of this particular crisis. And it's time the United States stops dragging its feet and catch up with the progress that everybody else seems to be embracing.
Thank you, Professor Madhavi, for taking the time to speak with me about this. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. And now back to the show. California has made significant progress in expanding healthcare coverage over the past decade, but that progress is now facing new challenges. Federal Medicaid cuts and state budget constraints could leave millions of Californians without insurance in the years ahead. From Sacramento, CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez speaks with CalMatters health reporter Kristen Wong about a new documentary examining what's at stake for patients, providers, and the state's healthcare system.
For more than a decade, California made major strides in getting more people health insurance coverage, thanks in large part to the expansion of Medi-Cal, the state's version of Medicaid, which provides insurance to millions of residents who are low income or have disabilities. And just 2 years ago, the state was close to providing universal coverage with a 95% insured rate. But that coverage is now facing an uncertain future. With major cuts passed last year by the federal government, and California putting its own restrictions in place as it faces budgetary challenges. And these changes could cause millions of people to lose coverage over the next several years. A new documentary from the nonprofit newsroom CalMatters, which partners with public media stations across the state, is exploring the human toll of those cuts. CalMatters health reporter Kristen Wong joins us now with that reporting. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicki. It's great to be here.
So there have been many changes to Medi-Cal after the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. How did this help expand coverage? Walk us through a little bit.
The original Medi-Cal or Medicaid federally program had a lot of restrictions to it. And one of the biggest restrictions was that if you were a low-income adult, but you did not have children, you did not qualify for this sort of public insurance program. And one of the massive expansions that the ACA allowed states to do was to insure these, they call them childless adults. It also slightly bumped up the poverty level that allowed people to qualify for the program as well. And as a result, in California, there were about 5 million additional people who previously were completely uninsured who were able to gain insurance through this program.
Wow. So that is a significant expansion, given that there's, you know, some 40 million Californians in the state. One of the people you spoke with for your documentary is Ramont Means, and he's telling you about his experience and struggles finding coverage. We're going to take a quick listen.
I don't have the luxury of taking off work, going to the doctor without it affecting my income. Today was an example of that. Because I wanted to go to the doctor, I had to miss work. Everybody knows the game in California. You want your check or you want benefits. You can't have both. So I'm on Medi-Cal.
What did you learn from Ramont and these really difficult decisions he's weighing between working and healthcare?
I think that Ramont's personal situation is one that is fairly common among people who have Medi-Cal health insurance. We're actually, as part of this project, sort of soliciting additional stories from people who are Medi-Cal enrollees and have gotten people already, even after just a day, saying similar things to Ramont. Ramont himself, he works two minimum wage jobs. He works 7 days a week, but because neither job is full-time, the employers are not required to give him benefits. And so we talked at length about how if he makes even just a little bit more money, he gets kicked off the Medi-Cal health insurance program, but it's not enough money to actually afford to be able to pay for private health insurance out of pocket. So it's kind of this like gap that I think a lot of people find themselves stuck in.
Given that there was this large expansion that you just walked us through after the Affordable Care Act, from what Ramont told you, what was the Medi-Cal system like before 2010 compared to today?
You know, California has made a lot of expansions to the Medi-Cal system that include both expanding access to those 5 million people that I mentioned and to improving benefits and the quality of care that's actually offered as well. Ramont told me and shared with us in the documentary that before the expansion, the system was extremely bare bones. And it was kind of like essentially pregnant women and people with disabilities and children were the only ones who could get health care. And it was a lot harder as well to find a doctor or see a specialist. And he shared with us that really sort of tragically, his wife, who passed away when she was 31, she had just given birth to their third child, and she started experiencing some unusual symptoms and just couldn't get to a doctor, couldn't see a doctor at all. And she ended up passing away from cervical cancer, which is a cancer that is, you know, has a very high survival rate if it's caught and treated early.
Oh, wow. I mean, that is just tragic and so, so frustrating. Fast forward to today, that was in 2008. The system is like far from perfect, but in Ramont's experience, is it better today compared to back then?
He says it is better today, that quite frankly, that he believes that today his wife would still be alive if she had access to the care that he and his children have access to now. It is certainly not perfect. I think people always have complaints about any kind of government program or what it may be even people with private insurance have complaints about wait times and things like that. But he says that access is a lot easier. People can see specialists and you're, you know, I think just taken a little more seriously as a patient as well.
So what are the limits or the requirements for someone to be on Medi-Cal today?
In California, you have to make less than 138% of the federal poverty level. I think that's about $22,000
yes.
for an individual. I'm not sure what the like sort of family equivalent is. And there are some other categories, you know, pregnancy. In California, we've expanded the program previously to undocumented immigrants as well with state funding. So immigration status does not matter in California as much as it used to. But those are sort of the requirements that you have to meet today. It's essentially an income limit.
Okay. So along with these expansions, I would imagine the costs have gone up as well for state funding. So how has Medi-Cal spending increased over the years?
Medi-Cal spending has increased pretty dramatically in the past, you know, 8 or 9 years. It has essentially doubled. The current, I think, bill is around $217 billion for the Medicaid program. And some of that has to do with these eligibility expansions. Adding more people is certainly going to cost more. But some recent budget analyses from the Legislative Analyst Office pin it more on increased benefits and the way that people are using the program. So people are using the program more and therefore they're spending more.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. And now back to the show.
You know, with this expansion over the years, at one point the state had an insured rate, a record 95%. I mean, that's near universal health coverage. I mean, is it that high today?
I think it's dropped a little bit, a couple of percentage points maybe in the past 2 or so years since I believe it's 2024 when the state hit 95% insured. A lot of the turmoil of sort of millions of people expected to lose coverage from recent budget cuts has not happened quite yet. So we still have a pretty high insured rate right now.
Okay. So there have been some changes at the state level, haven't really felt the true impact of that yet. But there's also changes, of course, at the federal level. You have H.R. 1, also called the One Big Beautiful Bill, made sweeping changes to Medicaid and other programs. Remind us what kind of hit this is for California.
H.R. 1 created huge financial problems for California. And some of those problems are future problems, and a little bit is happening right now. But the One Big Beautiful Bill Act cut about $1 trillion from healthcare over the next decade nationally. And in California, when all of the rules and regulations are fully in effect, California expects to lose about $30 billion a year, which is 15% of the current Medi-Cal budget.
I mean, you interviewed UCLA researcher Mark Peterson, and he described the impact to you. Let's take a quick listen.
And for the first time in history, through explicit policy choice, we are now boosting the percentage of the uninsured population in the United States.
You talk to so many voices in your documentary. I mean, what have you learned about who are the people that will be hit hardest by these cuts?
Low-income people are going to be hit incredibly hard by these cuts. I think one of the points that Mark Peterson was trying to make there is that a lot of the way that H.R. 1 is enacting the cuts is through changing eligibility requirements and requiring all of these people who got insurance through the Affordable Care Act expansion, those 5 million people, to comply with work requirements. And other states across the country in the past have sort of experimented with work requirements. And so there is evidence and research, and most of them have also reversed those work requirements as well, because they didn't really work. They did not increase employment, and the evidence is that it's people who qualify for the program who just kind of get caught up in bureaucratic errors and missing pieces of mail and things like that who end up losing insurance. And so that really is the population that's going to be hit the hardest and certainly hit first.
Yeah. And as we've learned, we've talked about this a lot on Insight, is that, you know, you basically like don't do preventative screenings and you don't check things before they get worse. And I think about Ramont, who you interviewed in your documentary, talking about his wife and believing that she would have been alive today if she had better health coverage compared to back in 2008. You also spoke with a physician assistant, Jesse Hoagland, talking about the importance of having insurance. Let's take a listen.
When someone does not have insurance, it really comes down to what can they afford. If they cannot afford insurance, can they really afford these medications? If I had someone who was having abdominal pain or pelvic pain and I needed them to do an ultrasound and I know I couldn't wait 6 months, I would have to send them to the emergency room, which is even more expensive than just getting the ultrasound.
Yeah, and we're regularly reminded that Medi-Cal and these cuts, because people will be forced to use the emergency room, it's going to impact healthcare, even if it's private insurance. I mean, what do the impacts on the local level look like when you were talking to physicians and going into hospitals? Like, what are they weighing right now?
I think they're weighing both system-wide impacts of they're going to have a lot of patients that they simply being able to take care of them is going to be a lot more limited. And those patients are going to have to go to the emergency room. And as you mentioned, you know, that's going to have ripple effects for sort of everybody else across the healthcare spectrum. Because if the emergency room is impacted and, you know, you're in a car accident or something like that, and you get taken to the emergency room, that is, or, you know, maybe your kid has the flu or something like that, you just have to wait in line with everybody else. And then I also think they're sort of weighing the like the very, very personal impacts as well, because when Jesse was talking about not being able to wait 6 months, he was referring to a time before the Affordable Care Act expansion. That was a normal thing that he had to do every single day with patients. And now it's a lot different. They can see specialists. They can get prescriptions very quickly. You know, people can afford these things. And while we were filming, we're not able to speak with the patient directly, but we sort of were able to talk through a specific case with Jesse where a patient had come in from the emergency room. He had some sort of diabetic emergency. He was uninsured and could not sign up for Medi-Cal. And the medications that he needed were almost, I believe, $700 a month.
Wow, that is, yeah, that's not possible for so many people. If you're just joining us, we're talking with CalMatters health reporter Kristen Wong about the impact of state and federal cuts on Medi-Cal recipients. So you're reporting, I mean, you've joined us so many times on Insight as a health reporter, of course, but this is a documentary that you put together, Inside California's Fight to Fund Healthcare. How did you go about approaching your reporting in this different format?
I think what I really wanted to focus on in this reporting was the human impact and the sort of the emotional toll that this was taking on both providers who are kind of boots on the ground and the patients who have to figure out how this is going to change their lives. Because as just a reporter, I think I'm sure you feel similarly, but like sometimes it feels like all of these changes, whether it's from the state or the federal government, are just coming at you relentlessly. And we're trying to parse the information for the public, but that is still a few degrees of separation away from like, how are real people thinking about this? And so that's kind of the heart of what I wanted to get to in this documentary.
Was it difficult to get people to talk about this, or did they just want to shout it from the rooftops?
I think at the beginning, it was more difficult to get people to talk about this because we started reporting before H.R. 1, the One Big Beautiful Bill, had passed in Congress. And at the time, there were also a lot of universities and even clinics and public health departments getting grants cut. And a lot of people were pretty, you know, hesitant to stick their neck out and say anything for fear that their institution might specifically be targeted for cuts. And so it was more difficult at the beginning, but I think as time rolled on and the cuts became real and people kind of realized like, now we have to deal with this, people were more willing to speak up. And it was also a little bit of a different dichotomy too with patients themselves. patients are not often super informed about these high-level policy changes, particularly not immediately when they're happening. It was also an exercise in like education, and because we were able to spend so much time with people over time, also track their evolving thoughts on how these changes would matter to them.
Yeah, and your reporting continues on this. I mean, you have several companion pieces that go alongside this documentary. And I saw in one of them, you even have like a Google Doc survey. I mean, what would you like from readers in the community?
I mean, we would love for people to read the stories, watch the documentary. And certainly our survey is for Medi-Cal enrollees specifically, but also if you have any, you know, family members or people in your life who know are going to be affected by this, you know, share it with them or fill it out and help us. We are just trying because we know that sort of the federal and state cuts very complex and have different dates attached to them over the next like year and a half. And so we know that these impacts are going to be rolling out for many Californians. And we want to keep hearing those community voices, those on the ground voices of people who really are trying to figure out what all of this means.
Kristen, as always, thanks for joining us.
Of course. It's great to be here.
That was CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez speaking with CalMatters health reporter Kristen Wong about a new documentary examining what's at stake for patients, providers, and the state's healthcare system. You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. And now back to the show. We close this week's program with a story that blends local history, craftsmanship, and the Central Coast wine industry. KCBX contributor Mira Honeycutt sits down with the team at Epoch Estate Wines to talk about restoring its historical property, sustainable farming, and what makes York Mountain a distinctive place to grow grapes.
York Mountain is a tiny appellation which received its AVA status in 1983. But its history dates back to 1882, when Andrew York acquired a 120-acre homestead in Templeton, and by 1895 established Ascension Winery, one of the first bonded wineries on the Central Coast. Over time, the winery changed several owners and its name to York Mountain Winery, until Bill and Liz Armstrong rescued the damaged property. At the time, it was officially condemned due to the 2003 earthquake on the Central Coast. In 2010, the Armstrongs established it as Epoch Estate Wines with a vision to preserve the legacy of this historic winery. To talk about Epoch Estate Wines, years-long restoration efforts, and her journey into winemaking is my guest, Jordan Fiorentini, Vice President of Winemaking and Vineyards at Epoch Estate Wines, known for its award-winning Rhone-style wines. She is joined by her husband, Manu Fiorentini. He's founder and CEO of iTech, a winemaking and brewing supplies company in Paso Robles. Welcome to Wine Country, Jordan and Manu.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
Jordan, you joined Epoch as their winemaker from the start, 2010. Talk about the early years and the tedious process of restoration.
Yes, yeah, so I actually wasn't the first winemaker at Epoch. There was one before me, but he was only there for a couple years. So sort of in the initial stages of planting the vineyard and making the first vintage. So just get that point out. But we also worked with Justin Smith at the beginning. He was our consultant on the project when we first started. So I was a winemaker in Sonoma County and moved down for this exciting project. And Manu took a chance on the area as well back in 2010. And at that point, Epoch was just two vineyard properties, our Paderewski Vineyard and our Catapult Vineyard, which are both in the Willow Creek sub-AVA of Paso Robles. And then we were making our wines at Denner Vineyards. At Denner, there are lots of young, you know, up-and-coming winemakers. Justin Smith was also there.
Like Anthony Yount.
Anthony Yount was there. Jacob Toft was there. Scott Holly was there. Amy Butler was there. I mean, the list goes on and on. It was like,
all the stars.
So much fun. So yeah. It was so great to sort of land in that place with a lot of colleagues that were, you know, similar age and everyone kind of establishing what their style in Paso Robles would be. when I joined Epic, I knew that we would be building a winery somewhere. I just didn't know exactly where. So Armstrongs have been looking for a property to have our tasting room and winery for many years. They're incredible people and very patient. So they knew that they wanted it to be the right place. So you mentioned 1882, Andrew York founded York Mountain, or the AVA, and then, well, the AVA didn't come to later, but the area, and then built the winery there. At the same time, a famous Polish pianist, composer, and actually politician named Ignacy Paderewski had come over to the United States to be a concert performer. He loved the U.S. He loved the idea of freedom. And he was an entertainer. He was the Elvis Presley of his time. And he's actually the character that Schroeder from the Peanuts is based on.
Yes.
So when he would play piano, he would do it so voraciously that the dust would become unsettled around him. And he had kind of crazy hair. So he was traveling in the U.S. We think he was probably in Seattle, and he had really bad rheumatoid arthritis. And his doctor at the time recommended that he come down to California to the Central Coast, Paso Robles specifically, to soak in the mineral hot springs in the area that were way more abundant at that time to ease his rheumatism. So he basically came down and stayed in the Paso Robles Inn and fell in love with the area.
And he planted vineyards.
He decided to plant orchards and vineyards. And we have correspondence from him and the professors at University of California. There was only one back then. It was in Berkeley. And he asked them what he should plant. And they said that he should plant Zinfandel in Duriff. And so he did that. And then he had a couple stints at winemaking, not in a specific winery. But then at a certain point, he asked the York brothers on York Mountain, this was probably the early 1900s, to make his wine for him. So the grapes back then, and then again today, travel between the Paderewski Vineyard, which is off Peachy Canyon Road, all the way
Not really far from York.
No, it's not too far, but it's still about a 20-minute drive. And back then, there weren't the same roads. And they were probably all dirt, I would assume.
And probably came in a horse and buggy.
Yes, exactly. And so the York brothers made Paderewski's wine, and now we're making wine from the Paderewski Vineyard on York Mountain again.
So what conditions were the vineyards in at Paderewski?
Actually, when we purchased the property, there was maybe a couple vines left that had washed into the creek bed. So back then, they weren't farming on very steep slopes like we are today. Right. They would probably farm on what was easier to farm with horses and without the tractors. So we did find a few old vines. They weren't in great condition, but we had received cuttings from a local person who had taken cuttings from a while back and propagated them.
Manu, you were born in Italy. Tell us about your journey to Paso Robles, and where and how did you two meet?
It's all about the story of love. You fall in love, you follow your woman wherever she leads you.
Well, you're a beautiful couple for those who can't see. This is radio.
Oh, wow. This is going in a different direction.
Okay. Hey, well, you know, I'm telling the truth. But did you meet here in Paso Robles?
We met in Italy. So I am born and raised in Italy, but moved between Rome, just above Milan, most of my youth, and eventually landed back to Tuscany, where my family from my father's side has had land for a long time. It's a big hunting retreat. They used to grow tobacco, grapes, had big cows for meat production and milk. And eventually, here I am in the year 2000, moving to be close to him and work in the sales of equipment. And one day, my dad calls me at work and says, "What are you doing for lunch?" And then the big journey of following this woman has begun.
I was working an internship at Antonori Winery in Florence.
And you drew him here.
I did.
Or he followed you here.
And I knew, through friends of friends, I knew of his father. So I contacted him when I had some time during harvest, and he invited me to the property and to have lunch. And then he invited his son over too. And then that's how we met.
That's cool. If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. My guests today are husband and wife team of Jordan and Manu Fiorentini. Jordan is Vice President of Winemaking and Vineyards at Epic Estate Wines, and Manu is founder of iTech, a winemaking and brewing supplies company. So, Jordan, there are various vineyards. You talked about Paderewski, Catapult, and the third one.
York Mountain.
Of course, on the property.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about your farming practices.
That's a great question because I'm super excited to report we are in transition to organic farming at the moment. But when I came to Paso in 2010, I knew that I wanted to produce wines that were not manipulated too much, as least as we possibly could in the vineyard and then in the winery. But I didn't really know what that meant until I started farming on the property. So it's a difficult landscape, especially in some vintages with the high limestone soils and the shale soils, the windswept hillsides and the crazy diurnal temperature swings. And so once I started farming, I realized that I needed to follow some tenets that weren't things that I had known so much about before when I was in Northern California. So I looked to biodynamics and organics to bring some life to the soils so that we wouldn't have to fertigate and add nutrients back as much, and then really produce healthy vines that would last a long time and their root systems would go deep into the earth. So we brought Philippe Armagnier on in 2011 to help us start biodynamic farming. And we've done that ever since 2011. However, we were never certified. And when you're biodynamically farmed, you're basically organically farmed as well. But again, we weren't certified. And so as time has moved on and the market has shifted, I realized it wasn't enough to just say we were following these principles. We actually had to, you know, put a stake in the sand and get certified. So that process began earlier this year with my amazing team. And because we've already been following almost all the principles anyway, we'll have our complete organic certification in August of next year. Some of our blocks are already completely certified. And then in August of next year, everything, all three vineyards at Epic will be CCOF. And then we're also looking to do the regenerative organic.
Yeah. Well, that's the next step, you know. So what's the total planted
About acres? 140 acres.
Between the three. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to be turned into certification.
They're all in CCOF, yes.
Yeah. So Manu, tell us about iTech. You import, right?
Correct. Yes. I'm an importer, distributor of equipment. So when we moved to 2010, it was, of course, a big leap of faith to come to a new area.
How did you start that? I mean,
when we moved from the East Coast, so Jordan and I met in Italy 2002, eventually 2003. I'm living with her in Georgia on the East Coast. Her family had just started a vineyard and winery. And to eventually understand vineyard and winemaking, we were both alongside with Jordan's father, helping out in every aspect of the business. And eventually, turns out most of the equipment you buy to make wine is either made in Italy or France. If you buy equipment for brewing, probably mostly German. But nonetheless, I remember my father-in-law saying, hey, you're Italian, figure out this manual. And all the manuals for the equipment was in Italian. So I became in charge of maintenance for the press, for the destemmer, for the bottling line, and everything else, of course, you do in a business with your family. And eventually moving to California in 2007 for Jordan's job at Chuck Hill Estate Winery in Hillsborough, we really didn't know what to do, because I'm thinking if she's working in the wine industry and we have a child at that point, 2 years old, our daughter, maybe I shouldn't be in the wine industry, because that way when she's busy at harvest, I can do something else and not also be busy at harvest.
Right.
But short-lived expectation, because she says, you speak Italian, French, English, a little bit of Spanish, you know all this equipment, and you've done sales your whole life. Maybe you should be a vendor in the equipment side of things. And
so she sparked the idea.
And so eventually we reached out to the company. We had purchased a bottling line back in the day on the East Coast, and turns out they had an office right in Windsor, 2 miles away from Hillsborough. And we eventually met, and that was my career start in the equipment sales side of things.
Yeah.
And 2010, we moved down to Paso, started my own LLC, began with equipment for an Italian company that mostly produced filters and presses, but really everything else. And at the same time, with a French company making some of the most prestigious oak barrels. Not within even a year, I decided this should be really just of my own, and I can add on things that can make sense. And one was the terracotta amphora, which are from Impruneta, right outside of Florence in Italy. Mm-hmm. The beginning of that was, I wish I could do what my wife wants first. If she likes the product, then everyone else around, all the other winemakers might understand the benefits and see the results. And the challenge was you start nonetheless with new products you may not be used with. And I was given Oregon, Washington State, British Columbia to cover. And so I had to make a lot of new friends and meet a lot of winemakers, understand every wine region, different climate and soils. In 2013, I also asked around, what do you think, if I had a filter, could you hire me and I bring this machine to you and I filter your wine? And so I found a few wineries willing to say yes. And that was the beginning of the service side of things for me. I provide mobile filtration.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You may know mobile bottling. It's bottling, a big thing for wineries. No one wants to commit to a $1 million line that gets used a couple times a year unless you are in deep pockets and you really want to control the full spectrum of wine production.
Yeah. Jordan, you take a fascinating look as an artist's approach to interpreting wine's texture and aroma profiles. Most people write notes. You draw. Talk about your visual communication that you call vinpressions.
Yes. Yeah, so it's my thought in the wine industry through grape growing and winemaking that if I do everything the best that I can in the vineyard and in the winery, the aromas and the flavors are what Mother Nature has given us. So when I blend and make winemaking decisions, whether it's picking or fermentation, draining, barrel use, and then most importantly, blending, I'm very texturally driven because those are the things that I can change with the blending. It's how I build wines is based on their texture. And so I found it very difficult to describe the texture and the sensation of the wine with just words. And I'm a very visual person. I also studied engineering as an undergrad at a liberal arts school. So I was like doing art and studying engineering. And I love the combination of the two. So I, with the encouragement of Bill Armstrong and other members of the Epic team, when we were releasing my first vintage, I said, I'll write the tasting notes, I'll use words, but I really feel like to connect with the consumer, I need to show them the shapes and the sensations I'm feeling on my palate.
That's really amazing. So you really translate your words into visual
images. Into visual. I actually put them on a sort of a big piece of paper. It's like a four-part quadrant. It's either I draw the quadrant in or it's just in my head, and it tracks the journey of the wine as it moves across my palate from front to back.
Fascinating. Well, thank you, Jordan and Manu, for joining us today. This was wonderful. You are listening to Jordan Fiorentini, Vice President of Winemaking and Vineyards at Epic Estate Wines, and her husband, Manu Fiorentini, founder of iTech, a winemaking and brewing supplies and services company in Paso Robles. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Mira Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
And that'll do it for this week's show. Our theme song is Soul Sync by Ketza. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX 90.1 FM in San Luis Obispo. Thanks to everyone who contributed to this week's program, the team at Cap Radio's Insight, and Mira Honeycutt. Today's show was mixed and produced by Emily Harris. Monica Lopez is our executive producer. Brad Kyle is the operations assistant. And I'm this week's host and KCBX assistant news director, Gabriela Fernandez. See you next time.